Okay. So, our topic, say what our topic is.
Reality distinguished from illusion.
Okay. Well, we know, we're very familiar with illusion, but what's reality? Reality distinguished from illusion. When you pick those three verses, since they're a little familiar with Bhagavad Gita, should I give a little background to these? He picked the topic, he picked the verses, I'm just sitting here. But the verses, the topic is a nice one, and the verses are also nice. There, it's from Canto 10 Bhagavatam. That's Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. And the section is Brahma, the creator of this universe, is offering some prayers to Krishna, who is the source of Brahma. And on the occasion of Brahma was visiting, he wanted to see Krishna's pastimes. Let's go back. Go way back. Brahma is the firstborn living being, according to the Vedic picture. He's born directly from the body of Vishnu, from Garbhadakshay Vishnu, the Lord of... There's a form of Vishnu within each universe. Garbo means egg. Garbo Dakshayi Vishnu. He is the within each universe. Garbo Dakshayi Vishnu enters. The universe is half filled with water, and it's darkness. The rest, the other half of the universe, and from his body comes the totality of karma of all the living beings within the universe. That's a lot of karma. And that karma comes from his body in the form of a lotus. And on the top of the lotus is a lotus flower. And one of the living entities in that universe appears on top of the lotus flower. It's a little different than Big Bang cosmology, but Brahma appears and he has a self-searching aptitude. So he wants to find out where he came from. So he climbs down the stem and he can't find the end of the stem. So then he hears some syllables. Ta, pa, three times. So he understands what that means. He's supposed to undergo tapa. So he goes back up to the lotus flower and he does some tapasya. Specifically, he meditates on a mantra that he receives from Krishna. He becomes self-realized, and then he realizes Krishna. There's some wonderful verses. This is background is there because he's already realized Krishna before there's even a universe. It says, you know, the hollow, the universe is compared to a coconut that has water in part of the coconut and a shell. And then there's the open part inside the coconut. So Brahma's up there, and it's darkness in all directions. There isn't anything. And he fills the place up with the lower, middle, and upper planetary systems. He builds the universe, and then he creates living entities from his own body that help produce the living entities to fill up the universe. So that's what Brahma does. But he is already way back before there even he built the universe. That's really good engineering to build the universe and all the living entities that fill it up. So he has full realization of Krishna. And according to the Vedic picture, each day of Brahma and followed by a night of Brahma, there's so many cycles of ages of mankind that pass. I'm looking at time. Cycles of ages. We're in the winter season. The dark age of Kali. But they cycle around. And once, there's 1,000 of those yuga cycles. 4,320,000,000 years is the duration of one yuga cycle. And then the night is of equal duration. So it's like a really long time. And 1,000 of those, Krishna appears. And it's very specific. Manu number 7, in the 28th yuga cycle, in Manu number 7, Vaivasvata Manu. So, he knows Krishna has appeared on earth, because he created the earth, and he knows when Krishna is going to appear. So he goes to earth to check it out. What's Krishna doing in his pastimes on earth? So he when he visits Vrindavan on earth, he sees a pastime that's, it's very amazing. Now, to create a universe, it's not just you have engineering skill. You have to have a lot of potency, shakti, power, creative power. Srishti shakti, it's called. And it's a mystical how he does what he does. And he sees Krishna perform some pastime. And then he, with his friends, they go and have lunch, sitting by the side of a river Jamuna. And he starts pondering, what's the extent of the potency of Krishna? So if I show some of my potency, maybe he'll show me more of his potency. So he gets this mistaken plan. He decides, while the cowherd boys are having their lunch, he's going to take the calves, because they're still little boys. They're like 5 years old, less than 5 years old. Think about the age. So he takes the calves and puts them in a cave. And the boys just say, wait a minute. The calves have wandered away. We have to protect them. Krishna says, don't worry. I'll find them. You just finish your lunch. He gets up. And while Krishna's gone to look for the calves, I mean, he knows where they are, but he's looking for the calves. Brahma takes the cowherd boys and puts them in a cave and goes back to the scene of the crime to see what's Krishna going to do. And when he goes back to the scene of the crime, he sees there's the calves and there's the cowherd boys having lunch. He's puzzled. So he goes back and looks in the cave. When he looks in the cave, they're in the cave. So he goes back and he's puzzled. He wanted to see the extent of Krishna's potency, his mystic power. So Krishna fulfilled his desire. Not only he manifested himself as the identical forms of each calf and each cowherd boy, from nothing into it. It was actually Krishna, but manifesting, looking like each of them. Then he simultaneously showing the forms of the boys, he manifested forms of Narayan for each of the calves and each of the cowherd boys, and personified Vedas and all the potencies of the Supreme Lord, and demigods worshiping, and big celebration, it's big cacophony of sound, and all these entities, all in one little space. He faints. He's overwhelmed. His circuit overload. And he comes again to external consciousness, looks up, and then he sees the whole universe in front of him. And he goes, wow. you really showed me what I was looking for. The extent of your power is there is no limit. And I have a little, and I build the universe. And you have unlimited, because you're the source of all power. Now, he knew that before, because that comes before he builds the universe. He gets darshan. He sees the personality of Godhead. And the personality of Godhead gives him instructions. It gives him his service. And so he does his service. He builds the universe. But he derives the power from Krishna. There's really, really nice, we just discussed it this morning, so I'm going to share. There's a really nice book, it's really skinny, like, you know, really skinny book, Brahma Samhita, 61 prayers, or verses, and so the middle part is prayers, and one of the prayers is a prayer to Govinda. The refrain is, Govindam Adipurusham Tamaham Bhajami. It's beautiful, beautiful. If you ever visit the temple, in the morning, there's Mangal Arati in the morning, and then they close the curtain and they dress the deities and make offerings to the deities, and they open the curtain. We all sing those Brahma Samhita prayers. Govindam Adipurusham Tamaham Bhajami. So one of those prayers is Brahma offering a prayer to Govinda about Brahma. And he uses a metaphor. And he says, just as the sun sometimes stores power in special gems that radiate light, not reflect light, but they store the light of the sun and they emit their luminous gems. So also Brahma receives power from Krishna to do what he does. It's just like a little portion of the unlimited power that Krishna has. And he knows his position in relation to Krishna, but he's just kind of like, what's the limit? And then he got the answer. There's no limit. And then he offers some wonderful prayers. So that's what Juvana Jivana recommended that I speak from. All of that was just a little backdrop so we can just touch on these three verses. So he's in Vrindavan, and he just had his mind blown. He's just like, whew, there's no limit. So what, think of something that has no limit, limit in time, limit in space. I mean, right in front of him, there's a whole universe. It's not like, you know, it's a piece of the universe. Not exactly what Arjuna saw in Bhagavad Gita chapter 11. He saw the universal form. Universal form is what Brahma built. He built the universe according to that structure of the universal form. He put it in, you know, 3D. But he saw the whole universe right in front of him. So, and all the other things that he saw. So his intelligence is saturated, his heart has melted, and he has enormous appreciation for Krishna, and specifically even, there's many, many texts, his specific appreciation for the residents of Vrindavan, because he's visiting Vrindavan, where Krishna descends from the spiritual world and makes his, performs his pastimes. So here's 22. It starts, tasmat, or therefore. This entire universe, because he built it, this entire universe, which is like a dream, is by nature unreal, nevertheless appears real. And thus it covers one's consciousness and assails one with repeated miseries. This universe appears real because it is manifested by the potency of illusion, emanating from you, whose unlimited transcendental forms are full of eternal happiness and knowledge. So, is the universe real or not real? The answer is it's real. But it's the potency is an illusory potency. Just like, here's an apple, and here's a mirror, and here's a reflection of the apple in the mirror. So is the reflection of the apple in the mirror real or not real? Well, it's not an apple, but it's a reflection of the apple. So it has some reality. But turn the mirror like that, and there goes the apple. Instead I'm gonna see what's out the window over there, because I turned the mirror over that way, and then over that way. So the mind is like a mirror, and in the mind we see things. Through the senses, this is now Sankhya philosophy. The senses are grouped around the mind, according to what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. A living entity travels from this body to the next body at the end of life, carried by the mind. The soul is carried by the mind, which has grouped around it the senses, the subtle senses, not like the gross sense organs, but the subtle senses that power the sense organ. So the mind sees the reflection, and that's what registers. So Brahma's created the reflection. It's a the place where we are, I mean, the house where we are right now, and etc. The whole universe is a reflection of spiritual reality. It's in Bhagavad Gita. The chapter where Krishna describes a tree where the branches are growing down and the roots growing up. You know that one? Have you covered that so far? No? It's in Bhagavad Gita. Branches growing down, roots growing up, no such tree. But in the reflection, here's a body of water, lake or pond or something. Here's a tree. Branches are up, roots are down. In the reflection, the branches are down, the roots are up. So this is a reflection of the real thing. I visit China, and they've heard this expression. I was surprised. I've asked in many different audiences. There's this phrase, I ask, in China, do you have this phrase, as above, so below? They say yes. So, as on the bank of the lake, so below. But it's upside down. And then when the water becomes disturbed, the image becomes also distorted. So it's a perverted reflection of the spiritual reality, and that's what this place is. And that's what Brahma is, I mean, not just Chicago or Bangalore or wherever wherever else in this earthly planet, but the whole cosmic manifestation. The universal form that Brahma creates, it goes up, and at the very top, it's like the org chart of a CEO is at the head of an organization, and then down below the CEO is an org chart that shows all kinds of other people doing all kinds of things, and it's all connected to somebody at the top. And the somebody at the top in the universal form or the structure of the universe is Brahma. He's at the top. And that's where the root is. And the branches are growing down. So, he built the universe. Now he's speaking to the person he got the power to build the universe from, saying, This is a reflection of the reality. It appears to be real because it's from the reality. As above, so below. But it's upside down. And distorted. So then, he's using a tata, yata tata. As this, so that. It's a metaphor. So in a dream, we see stuff. And when you're dreaming, you forget, who you are when you're awake. So over here in your dream. And the dream can be your king, or the dream can be there's a lion chasing you, and you scream, But there's no lion, you're not a king. It's just a dream. So just like this is like a dream. It's the reflection is like a dream is to real life. The reflection is to the reality. That he's saying to Krishna, you're the reality. This appears to have reality because it's connected to you. Because you're reality. But actually it's not false. Just like the picture of the image of the apple in the mirror, or the reflection of the tree in the body of water. It's not that it doesn't exist, but this is now Srimad Bhagavatam teaching. The reality is sat, and non-reality or illusion is asat. It's asat means temporary. Sat means eternal, ever existing. Like, for example, the soul is sat. The body is not sat. We get one, and it stays for some time, and gets old, and gets finished, and then you go on to the next one. So the sat goes on to the next asat. So we're not who we think we are. That's illusion to think we are who we think we are. And who we really are is sat. And Krishna is the root of all such reality. But the non-reality or the illusion appears to be real because it's from sat, or param satyam, the supreme truth. So this asat, or the dream, the illusion, covers consciousness, it covers our real happiness, it covers our capacity to see what really is. So that sounds like a problem, if you can't see what really is. And you're accepting what isn't to be what really is. This universe appears real because it is manifested by the potency of illusion emanating from you, whose unlimited transcendental forms are full of eternal happiness and knowledge. I'll go through the other two verses, and it's a lot of philosophy. I'll try to bring it down to something practical. The next text, you are the supreme soul, the primeval supreme personality, the absolute truth. Absolute truth in Vedic terms means that which is the source of everything. I mean, yeah, there's lies and truth, that kind of truth. And then there's the source of something, and other things are resting upon that source of something. Pratishtha, the Sanskrit term. Krishna is the Pratishtha of Brahman, chapter 14, Bhagavad Gita. Brahman is the vastness of the spiritual sky, and the vastness of the spiritual sky is resting on Krishna, he says in Bhagavad Gita. And this material creation is just a cloud in the vastness of the spiritual sky with so many universes and things. But it's all resting on Krishna. That's the absolute meaning of absolute truth. Self-manifested, endless and beginningless. You are eternal and infallible, perfect and complete, without any rival, and free from all material designations. Upadi, material designations. Like, you know, a material designation means I'm a sannyasi, and he's a grihastha. So, you know, that's not who we are. Or I'm American, and you're Indian. It's not who we are. I mean, it's not who we are. It's a designation, but it's not who we are. We may abide by what a proper designation is. You know, you're a grad student in, was it data processing? Data science. So that's a That's an upadhi. You're the spark of life within, and you're doing some duty, etc., etc. And then there's the spark of life within that's being carried by the body, and the body's doing things. And it's not like we just trash the covering. We use it. We use it in practical ways. But the idea of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam is while doing all that stuff to know who you are. There's a really, if you haven't seen it, please, I invite you to view it. I've viewed it 6 or 7 times. It's a movie that took about a year to make. It's a documentary that was intended to be for commercial audiences, not just, you know, devotee audiences, literally in public theaters, but it's now available on YouTube. It's just called the Hare Krishna movie, something, something. It's about Prabhupada. And one of the sections I like a lot, he's sitting there with a television reporter, and the reporter is asking him, Swamiji, you came to this country, obviously you had a message. Could you share with us what was that message you wanted to pass on to everybody? And in 3 words, know yourself. And the reporter said, know yourself? Prabhupada said it again. Yes, know yourself. 2 words. And that's, unpack it and it's a big thing. But illusion covers who we really are, and we live a life of illusion, forgetting who we really are. The whole of, since you're studying Bhagavad Gita, the whole of Bhagavad Gita, the whole of the Vedas, is to know who you are. I mean, that's a starting point, is Aham Brahmasmi, you're this chapter 2 Bhagavad Gita. Did you get that far? So that's who you are. But that's not the complete picture of who you are, because you're not just a spirit like a twinkling star in the sky somewhere. There's this whole thing that we're part of. We're part of something. And that's part of who we are. There's a relationship with our source of emanation. Along with us inside the heart, we come to find out from Bhagavad Gita, there's a second soul, Dvisuparna. There's a second bird within the tree, the observer bird, Upadrashta, the overseeing bird, the witness bird. That's a super soul. He's observing everything. He's not jumping from branch to branch in the tree. He's just observing the one who's jumping from branch to branch in the tree. And if that jumping bird hits the pause button and says, hey, who's that other bird over there? The witness bird. That's part of self-realization, knowing who you are. We're part of something that's much bigger. And then there's a relationship. And you learn what that relationship is. And you act in that relationship. And that takes you to the full stage of realization of who you are. And your relationship with the source of everything. That's what's happening here with Brahma. And so that's what he's saying in the text. Your happiness can never be obstructed, nor can you have any connection with material contamination. Indeed, you are the indestructible nectar of immortality. It's a nice phrase. You are the indestructible nectar of immortality. And then the final. Those who have received the clear vision of knowledge from the sun-like spiritual master can see you in this way, as the very soul of all souls, the super soul of everyone's own self, the two birds in the tree. It's one thing, it's one step to understand that we're not the body, the covering, but we're the spark of life within. and the spark of life within has a companion within. It's incomplete without recognizing who the companion soul is. That's the supreme soul that we're subordinate to and meant for service to. And that leads to that realization, acknowledgement, leads to living your practical life, being a data scientist, yes? Or yoga teacher? Or what do you do?
Engineer.
Huh?
Engineer.
Or whatever you do. And you do what you do, perform prescribed duties, Krishna's teaching in Bhagavad Gita, and at the same time, always think of him. Mama Nusmara. Always think of him. So how do you always think of, I mean, supposing you're doing your data science, you're doing your engineering, you're doing your yoga, how do you always think of Krishna while you're doing all that stuff? And the science is love. When you have love, here's a young boy, young girl, and they have romance. They don't have to be told, think of each other. They're thinking of each other while they're brushing their teeth or while they're, you know, supposed to be studying or looking out the window and thinking of each other because they have some love for each other. They have some attachment. That's how you can always think in all circumstances, even in your sleep. 24/7, at least when you're waking, you can, right? So it's bhakti, the essence of Bhagavad Gita, and what's being taught here also by Brahma is be mindful of your eternal companion. So you have, supposing you have a relationship with a friend or a parent or a whatever relationship, someone. So there's you and there's that someone, and both you and that someone have super soul within their heart. So it's not like, you know, it's like two is company and three is a crowd. But he's there. So, and that realization, that awareness is part of what the bhakti process is, or part of what it means to know yourself. Perform your prescribed duties, become really good at it. And at the same time, always think of Krishna. Mama Nusmara Yudhya. Thus understanding your original personality, they are able to cross over the ocean of illusory material existence. Crossing over the ocean of illusory material existence doesn't mean you just check out. Like, I'm out of here. It's, you cross over. You live your life in a full and responsible and everything way. And it's just not entangled in it, in the complexities of material life. You still have to, I mean, winters in Chicago are winters in Chicago. And so you deal with it. It's not like it stops being, the external forces stop doing what external forces do. But you cross over the ocean of material existence by not accepting it as reality. You just deal with it in a responsible way while you're pursuing higher consciousness. So we have psychophysical nature. He's got his. Each of us have ours. We don't deny it. We accept it and we engage it in such a way that it will serve to elevate consciousness. So there are core activities. Some of them you're already doing. Studying Bhagavad Gita, it's just like gets a good start, because the sound vibration is teaching us the science of how to live your life in such a way that the illusion is compared over here to reality. like I'm thinking I'm the body, and Krishna's telling me I'm not the body. And I've been practicing Krishna consciousness for a good number of years now, like more than 50 years, full time, nothing else. So it has its benefit, it has a cumulative effect. And it's not, you know, you have to do that for 50 years and then bell rings or something. It's as you invest consciousness according to your nature, you invest consciousness in sat. While you're navigating your way through the temporary. I mean, it's not, so there's Brahma and then there's us. Brahma created the universe and he's calling it illusory. It's not like he's not trashing his life's work. He's in charge. He's up at the top of the org chart. He's the root of the whole thing. And when the demigods have a problem, they go to him. And when he's got a problem he can't solve, he goes to Vishnu. He knows, you know, he has a big role to play. So he's not trashing his work of creating the universe, but he's being very clear. It's illusory. And I'm involved in what my duties are, I'm not going to identify with them. I'm going to carry them out responsibly and recognize this is a reflection of you. It appears to be real because of it's from you and you're real. And so I'm going to deal with it because here I am. I have this Lord Brahma body that lasts for the duration of the entire universe. We don't have, you know, ours lasts much shorter. However many count, you know, 70, 80, 90, 100 maybe, whatever, then it's over. This body is over. Brahma's lasts for the whole universe. But it's temporary. And so while I have this temporary body, I'll use it wisely, prudently, and as far as the results of the work, this is chapter 3, Bhagavad Gita, you offer the results of your work to the Supreme by acts of sacrifice. Yajna by Vishnu. You know, check out. You act responsibly, fully to your capacity, and you use everything that's in your resources you have and faculties you have. And elevate your consciousness so that you come to the point where you know who you are while you're doing all those things. Not just do all those things or don't do any of those things, just focus on, you know, self-realization. That's not the recipe for Bhagavad Gita. It's you do your prescribed duty and you learn the science of who you are and how to awaken that consciousness. So Brahma has that awakened consciousness, and he's seeing the topic now, illusion, as opposed to reality. You don't have to live a life of illusion. You can live a responsible life of reality in that which is asat, it's temporary. The body is temporary, the mind is temporary, the feelings and emotions within the mind, they're temporary. Everything that's measurable is by time and space is in this asat category. And we don't trash it. We use it in service to the source from which it comes, or making that link with the source from which it comes. That's what yoga is. Linking with the Supreme. That's the meaning of yoga. Linking with the Supreme. Since I don't know you, I don't know, I was not really sure what level, what, you know, 101 or 201 or 301, you know, what level to go at. So I just followed him. Any discussion? Your thoughts on this?
So, like,
We have some people online that would want to hear what you say.
So in my life, like, you know, after my father passed away, and this is my experience in life, so I was, like, going through a lot, like, my divorce, my father passed away, my child is, like, 6 months old, and I'm like, what is happening? Like, you know, I have no clue of any situation. So one thing I did was I read this book, Many Lives, Many Master, and then I thought, let me read my horoscope. And I read my horoscope from the perspective, like, what is it that I'm born with, not from a perspective that I want to change anything. And when I started reading it, and I'm like whatever happened has happened because it was supposed to happen. And so after that, I stopped questioning my life. I started living it. I just think this will happen. I read my horoscope like once a year or something just to know what is to happen in my life, to be mentally prepared for it. I don't want to change it. I just want to face it thinking that this is the creation. This is what I have to live. And what surprises me is that, like, coming to the point, like, reality versus illusion, if everything is already written when I was born, so there has to be some illusion about it because it was there even when I was born. And so I was like, okay, I will go with the plan. Face it, I will have my faith in Krishna that he is there. He wants me to live through this life. So, and wherever I feel I'm struggling, only thing that I tell myself is try 100,000 times before you give up. And more you try, you will get better at it. So, yeah, this is my experience of my life, and I could see a lot of change in myself. And the amount of positivity and the amount of help that I get from this whole universe and the people around me.
Do you know the meaning of karma, right?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know the meaning of prarabdha karma? It's an adjective. There's different stages of karma, and the one that's happening now, that's prarabdha karma. And then there's three other stages. It's about to happen. It's in a seed, and it's just subtle. It's not stirring yet, but it's there. Then the seed and start to fructify, about to fructify, then it's happening, prarabdha karma. So according to the bhakti process has the power to completely level the prarabdha karma. Like, zip. Doesn't mean the stars aren't, you know, if it's going to be cold in Chicago in the winter, or if there was this in Rogers Park, there was a tornado that hit and lasted for 20 seconds and knocked over trees. So it's not like the tornado is not going to happen if you engage in bhakti. Forces will come. If it's going to rain, you can carry an umbrella, but you know it's going to rain. So influences may come, but they don't act. For one who's engaged in bhakti, it has the power of neutralizing that impact in determining how you're going to respond, and then the next event and the next event, because the next event has a lot to do with how you respond.
Exactly.
So bhakti makes the connection with Krishna, and it levels prarabdha karma. So the value in of this discussion is who is that person who we want to connect with? So, you know where the train's going when you get on a path that leads to Krishna, what's on the other end? And by making that connection in devotion, then prarabdha karma becomes leveled. You don't become impacted in the same way that someone that doesn't know Krishna is impacted emotionally, practically, and so forth. Okay, good. Yeah.
I have two questions.
Two questions.
So the first is, so we were talking about prescribed duties. So I was wondering, when one is trying to perform their prescribed duties while remembering Krishna, what does it look like? How does it feel? What's the difference between just trying to go on with life and trying to perform one's duties while remembering Krishna?
That's a big question. To keep it simple, the light that you work with when you're doing prescribed duty and offering the result to Krishna is the light of the Vedas. And the light of the Vedas will give you some understanding or some light what your duty is. Because there are some people in this world that think they're following the Vedas and say work is worship. My going to the office and, you know, doing my work, karma evadikaraste ma paleshu kadashana. That's what I do. I just do my work, and work is worship. That's my worship, as I do my work. That's not what prescribed duty is. Prescribed duty means, according to, not just go to the office, but I have a psychophysical nature, and according to psychophysical nature, there's prescribed work. For the intellectual person, there's this type of work, and for the administrative person, there's that type of work, and there's qualities that are to be, that accompany that type of work. Character and so forth. So if I have the light of the Vedas to guide me and a good teacher to help me understand what the Vedas say about me and my nature, then I follow the Vedas. And I offer the result to Krishna. So what it looks like is you're not entangled. You're doing side by side two persons, one who's in la-la land and the other person that's performing prescribed duties and offering the results to Krishna. It may externally may look the same. The physical activities may look the same. But the consciousness is very different. One is entangled and the other is liberated or connected or linked with that which is the source of everything. And the goal is to gradually become clear and clear and clear and clearer about that source and one's relationship with that source. So that's what it feels like, although externally it may look somewhat similar, not identical. Yeah?
Yeah. The challenge, though, is that I feel like today everyone chooses what they want to do
based on
what it feels what feels good.
Yeah.
I guess that's not how one would want to choose then.
Well, in one sense, that which comes natural, you know, guided by the Vedas, that's a big clause at the front, guided by the Vedas, we have our nature and, you know, some like pizza and some like pakoras. And that's fine. But you offer to Krishna. And then you follow the prescriptions of how you make offerings to Krishna. Not just like flip it in the air and offer to Krishna. No. So we follow some cultural guidelines of conduct. And as you go further, it can become more refined and more refined and more refined. I mean, you know, like if you were to ask Jumuna Jivana, do you like being an engineer? You might get, you know, I'm not so sure I made the right choice about career. But here I am because somebody back there said you can get a good living by you becoming an engineer. So he became an engineer because he was following the advice of somebody who was a well-wisher. And now he's an engineer. So he's now maintaining his family. He's not like complaining about it. But it may not be his psychophysical, that, you know, a really good match for his psychophysical nature. But then he's finding other things that do match more his psychophysical nature within that framework, and he's growing and developing. He'll tell you about it. this Karuna care thing sounds really like something that really fits his nature. So, the ideal is from the, you know, what Prahlad Maharaj says, from the tender age of childhood, Komara Acharat Pragyo Dharman Bhagavataniha, to learn from childhood. But if one doesn't, so like with his children, that's the opportunity they have. And they, you know, I'm sure they have their nature, as we all do. And so the teacher, in this case the mother, has the responsibility, and father, what's their nature, and give resources that match their nature, not just put the square peg in the round hole. But what's their nature? What's going to make you a lot of money when you grow up and so you can have a comfortable life? That's not the advice that they're getting. It's not the training that they're getting. So they're going to be more likely to discover what their real nature is and have activities that match their real nature. But for as you said, for the rest of us, it's just, you know, I like it. It feels good.
Thank you, Maharaj. And my second question was, so I'm performing my duty, and then how do I make sure that I'm not getting carried away and I'm under the guise of saying, oh, I'm just trying to perform my duty correctly, but what I'm really doing is I'm just getting consumed by it and I'm getting lost in the illusion that we talked about.
Well, I think it's safe to assume there's, because you're asking this question very sincerely, it's safe to assume there's a mix. Because we're conditioned. So there's some of the, you know, perform prescribed duties and offering result to Krishna because you've been very carefully trying to understand Bhagavad Gita and live by it. So that's the purification side, and then there's the conditioning side. So assume there's something of a mix. So now, that's a fair assumption. Now, then what? So you just acknowledge that's my situation. Kind of like what she said, here's my situation. It is what it is, and I'm accepting my situation what it is. Let me, well, move towards the light, and as I move towards the light, then the darkness, the cloudiness, will diminish. So I just gradually keep moving towards the light. Or towards that connection with Krishna and trying to understand what that means and trying to live by it, bringing it inside, which is what you're doing. So it's a gradual evolution of consciousness.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
I don't exactly know how to start this, but I'll try. Okay. So besides a yoga teacher, I've always been working in a business, and more specifically, I've been a sales manager for a long time.
A self manager.
Sales.
Health.
Sales manager,
and mostly in fashion industry.
Oh.
So, as you probably know, there's not so many people who would like to hear anything about God in this industry. And I'm not going to go into details, but it's almost like if I say I believe in God and I'm doing celibacy, people would think I am absolutely crazy. So I'm about to cry, but I'm going to try not to cry. So I'm just sharing the experience that, you know, ever since I started, like believing in God more and more, which I'm from Eastern Europe, but like we don't really have someone to explain to us what is going on. Like, what is this knowledge of pure love? I've never heard of unconditional love. Nobody ever told me that this animal exists. It was just like, okay, what if love is love, and like, this is like, you grow up in the family, and then you get married, you create your own family. That's what love is. There is like, that is love, you know, this is what the love is.
Yeah.
But like, when I came here, and like, when I saw like, when I was studying in moksha yoga, and meanwhile I've always been in fashion industry, and I help people to look to like style themselves, and like I also work in theater, so it's a lot of like I've always been surrounded by a lot of like performances. Like, people always tell me, oh my God, how are you so excited? And then I'm like, because I celebrate life. That's God, that's what I feel like God wants me to do. To celebrate life, to be excited that today I woke up, I see the sun, and then I'm just like, the simple things that like a lot of people don't really see. But if I start sharing that what exactly makes me excited, and that I am actually, I don't want to have a boyfriend because I don't think that this is something necessary right now, people would probably think I'm crazy. So what I do is like,
I keep it internal,
and thank you for letting me share this. But like, I just like I know a lot of models, for example, people who work for like famous designers, people who are like, they want to be models, or they are already models, they've been there for a long time. And there is a thing that, when they hear things that I learn from God perspective, how to love yourself and how to be beautiful, they're like, oh my God, nobody ever told me that. Like, it seems like this world is in the need of love,
yeah,
of this unconditional love. How to like, because I know that Bhagavad Gita, it says that, okay, the body is not important, but honestly, if we are not comfortable with our body and our self-image, it is going to bother us a lot. So I would say that in one point, it's important to be, at least in what I've been experiencing, it's important to be very like, to be comfortable with your look, but after that, to like work on the internal things. Because if we don't really like certain things about ourselves, we're going to be so distracted about thinking about this in our psyche that it's almost like there's not even time to like work internally. At least these are my experiences with fashion industry, like I'm just sharing that. But I know that maybe you have different kind of perspective. So I would say that even though everything in this industry looks like it's outside, people are really in need to feel loved. And then they start doing other things that in the Bhakti society we don't do, such as drinking and taking drugs. In the beginning, I was questioning why people are doing so many things that are like against God, like such as taking some kind of like external things, like, or like overeating, or like not eating at all, or some kind of extremes. It's just because nobody really was there to like
guide them.
I'm sorry? To provoke them that this is not what is important. So I had to go myself as a yoga teacher through a lot of like, don't judge yourself, don't judge people of their experiences. And then they would come. But really, I was thinking before, oh, young people, they don't want to believe in God. Well, that's not really true. It's not that they don't want to believe. It's just that when we are surrounded by other young people who don't necessarily even mention